Spring 1944. Just after midnight, a B-24 Liberator bomber airplane sliced through the night sky, crossing the English Channel into Nazi-occupied France. Nancy Wake pressed against the side of the airplane, trying her best not to throw up. The air sickness, mixed with a brutal hangover, made for one of the worst plane rides she'd ever had. With her was Major John Farmer, codename Hubert. Hubert, in an attempt to make Nancy feel better, offered her a Spam sandwich and a cup of coffee. Entering France, the B-24 dodged German anti-aircraft fire. Nancy's headache intensified as the ride got even bumpier. She tried to think of the mission, of her husband, Henri, and if he was safe in Marseille. Just after 1 a.m., Nancy and Hubert looked out of the floor hatch. The countryside was ablaze with bonfires. It seemed like the whole German army was waiting for them. No matter. They got the green light. Hubert jumped first and disappeared. Now, it was Nancy's turn. But Nancy, uncharacteristically, froze. She needed some help from the dispatcher. He gave Nancy a shove out of the bomber. Her parachute immediately opened and she descended, suddenly exhilarated. Her nausea dissipated. She was finally back in France, on her way towards her husband, Henri, on her way towards the resistance. And she had a new mission: help the French prepare for the impending Allied invasion of Europe. This is Espionage, a Parcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. This is our second and final episode on Nancy Wake, one of the most successful spies during World War II. Last week, we explored Nancy's first stint with the French Resistance and her escape through the Pyrenees Mountains. This week, we'll follow Nancy as she becomes an integral part of preparing the French Resistance for the Allied invasion of Europe. You can listen to all of Parcast shows on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out every Friday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. Spring 1944. After 16 brutal weeks of training, Nancy Wake was officially a member of Britain's Special Operations Executive. Through those 16 weeks, she became an expert spy, specializing in explosives, firearms, and intelligence. Anything and everything clandestine. Now, the time had come to put that education into practice. Days after graduating from SOE training, Nancy received her orders. She was to parachute into the Lauvergne Forest, 60 miles from Vichy, and make contact with the thousands of Maquis, or French resistance groups, scattered around the mountains and countryside. From there, she would assess their needs and radio back to London so that England could parachute in supplies. There was a list of railways, bridges, factories, and roads that needed to be destroyed the moment the Allies hit the beaches of Normandy. Nancy was more than just ready. She was excited. The night of her jump, she decided to head to the Astor Club for one more round with the boys. But Nancy, being Nancy, couldn't just have one round. As the night progressed, she kept drinking, and she noticed how glum the men around her were. One man in particular, former Hollywood stuntman René Dussac, practically wept in front of Nancy, fearing that the two would never see each other again. Nancy took one look at him, claimed that he was just jealous that she was leaving before him, and kissed him hard. At the end of March 1944, Nancy and Major John Farmer, aka Hubert, boarded the B-24 Liberator to France. They were each carrying 1,000,000 francs, revolvers, and a cyanide pill, just in case they were caught. These were the tools with which they would build a rebellion. But first was the hangover, motion sickness, and a push into the unknown of Nazi-occupied France. Nancy landed in a tree. She couldn't believe her luck and cursed under her breath. As she struggled to cut herself loose, she heard the sounds of footsteps approaching. Instinctively, she reached for her revolver. But suddenly, a cheerful French voice erupted from the darkness. "Ah, that England would send such a beautiful flower," it said. Nancy looked down. Below her stood Henri Tardiva, a young, handsome Maquis who, before the war, was a math teacher. Nancy was relieved, but she was in no mood for French flattery. She immediately demanded that Tardiva cut her down. Once she was safely on the ground, she inquired about Maurice Southgate, the man she and Hubert were supposed to meet. Tardiva had never heard of him. Tardiva escorted Nancy to the town of Condelier, picking up Hubert along the way. Once they arrived, Nancy got her first taste of what it was going to mean to rough it while in the field. There was one double bed between her and Hubert. Nancy slept under the covers, while Hubert was forced to sleep on top of the sheets and used coats as blankets. She was a long way from her plush bed in Marseille with Henri. The plan was to wait until Maurice Southgate made contact. From there, they would meet with Gaspar, the leader of the Maquis resistance fighters in the area. They were also waiting for an old friend of Nancy's from her SOE training days, Dennis Rake. Rake would be Nancy's radio operator, sending coded messages back to London with Nancy's supply requests. Days went by, and there was still no sign of Rake or Southgate. Something wasn't right. Nancy was getting concerned. On day 4, her fears were confirmed. The Gestapo had arrested several of Southgate's men, and Rake was having a hard time getting out of Montluçon. Nancy and Hubert would have to find their way to Gaspar without him. After 3 days of cajoling her French hosts, Nancy finally made headway. They'd take her to see the Maquis leader. Gaspar was tall and brutish and didn't hide his arrogance. The thought of working with the British disgusted him. Nancy knew right away that he was going to be difficult to work with. She was going to have to prove she was here to fight. The day she met Gaspar, he and his men were planning to raid a sporting goods store in the German-infested town of Sonfleur. Nancy wanted in. She knew if she was able to hold her own, then maybe she could chisel away at Gaspar's disdain for her. Although the Maquis thought it too dangerous for a woman to join them, Nancy persisted and was allowed to go. The raid went off without a hitch. They quietly entered the town, broke into the store, and stole as much camping equipment as they could fit in their bags and hands. Tents, boots, survival supplies. Nancy loved this kind of clandestine activity. The excitement that she felt smuggling Allied soldiers across the Pyrenees was rekindled. Gaspar was impressed, but not impressed enough. Perhaps he couldn't get over his disdain for foreigners, or perhaps he didn't like the idea of working with a woman. Regardless, he decided Nancy and Hubert would be better off working with a lesser Maquis leader. He sent them to Henri Fournier in the village of Chaudieg. Fournier wasn't arrogant like Gaspar. He didn't view Nancy with suspicion or derision. He saw the value she and Hubert brought to the cause. With her in his camp, he'd have access to British supplies. However, that was contingent on whether Nancy's radio operator, Rake, ever arrived. Much to Nancy's relief, Rake finally did show up, after weeks traveling through the French countryside, dodging German patrols. Nancy was thrilled he'd survived. Now they could really get to work. Rake set up his radio and pulled out his book of codes. The codes were a collection of cryptic phrases that he could broadcast over the radio waves. To any Germans listening in, they sounded like nonsense. But to British agents who knew how to decode them, they made perfect sense. Rake ended all his messages, in most cases supply drop requests, with, "The cow jumped over the moon." Nancy and Rake would then listen to the BBC, waiting to hear "The cow jumped over the moon" broadcast back to them through a news bulletin. When they heard the phrase, they knew a supply drop was happening that night. Within 2 days of Rake's arrival in April 1944, British airplanes hovered over the designated drop zone and parachuted in supplies. Boots, Sten machine guns, and explosives. Christmas came early for Fournier's Maquis. The supply drops continued for 6 straight nights. Word spread, and new recruits joined the group. Gaspar was still considered the Maquis leader, but everyone knew that the group to join was Fournier's. The following weeks were a complete whirlwind of activity. While Hubert trained the Maquis with their newly acquired arsenal, Nancy traveled from camp to camp to assess what each group needed. She dodged Nazi patrols as she went. It was worth the risk. The Allied invasion would happen in just a few months. They needed to be ready. As Nancy's reputation grew, the Maquis objected less and less to following the orders of a female agent. She accomplished this in part by drinking Maquis leaders under the table. The Frenchmen were astonished by how much alcohol she could consume. Hubert, years later, told Nancy's biographer Peter Fitzsimmons that watching her drink with the Maquis remains one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. The drinking may have served another purpose. It helped Nancy to cope with the brutality of war. In early May 1944, Nancy was called to the secret base at Montmouchet by one of Gaspar's lieutenants. It appeared that they had caught a Gestapo double agent attempting to assassinate Gaspar and wanted Nancy to question him. She was delighted. This was a perfect opportunity to get some intelligence on the enemy. But as she inched closer to the barn, she heard the sounds of screaming. She steeled herself, but the blood-curdling shrieks were jarring. Even more so was the sudden stench that filled the air. It was foul, like burnt pork mixed with charcoal. It took everything in Nancy not to vomit, as it grew stronger and stronger with each passing step. When she entered the barn, she couldn't believe her eyes. The Gestapo double agent was bent over a table and tied down. His trousers were at his ankles. Blood streamed down his leg. Nancy looked over and saw a Maquisard holding a hot poker. Without saying a word, she slowly walked around to see the face of the man being tortured. And when she finally got a good look, the horror in her bubbled over. She knew this man. He had infiltrated the resistance a year earlier in 1943 and betrayed her partner, Pat O'Leary. Agent 47, the man she knew as Roger. Coming up, Nancy closes the book on the man who betrayed her friend. Now, back to the story. In May of 1944, Nancy Wake was presented with a Gestapo agent who betrayed her friend Pat O'Leary the year earlier. She knew him as Roger, or Agent 47. Nancy's French comrades had stuck a hot poker up Roger's anus, and the smell of burning flesh filled the barn. Nancy stared at the scene, momentarily immobilized. She thought of O'Leary, rotting away in Dachau concentration camp as a result of Roger's betrayal. O'Leary almost certainly had been tortured himself and was probably dead. Roger deserved this, part of her insisted. But she couldn't think like that. Her side could not stoop to the level of the Nazis. They weren't the oppressors. They had to be better. She stared at the scene a moment longer, then told the Maquis Czar to end the torture and execute him. Nancy was walking back to the chateau when a single gunshot echoed across the countryside. Nancy sighed in relief. For the rest of May, it was business as usual for Nancy and the growing Maquis army she was supplying. Night after night, Nancy would radio in additional supply requests and Hubert would train the men with the supplies they received. And with each passing day, the anticipation for the Allied invasion increased. June 6th, 1944. It finally happened. D-Day. Over 140,000 American, British, and Canadian soldiers descended on the beaches of Normandy on the French coast. It was the largest amphibious assault in history. As Hitler quietly slept in the safety of his home in Berlin, thousands of French resistance fighters cut down German communication cables and destroyed German supply lines. They leveled steel factories around Clermont-Ferrand and Montluçon, bringing German weapon production to an abrupt halt. In the days after D-Day, Nancy, Hubert, René, and the Maquis paraded around the countryside, blowing up anything German they could find. Nancy strategized targets and continued to organize weapon and ammunition drops. The guerrilla war was on. German retaliation was savage. They burned the houses and farms of anyone they suspected of working for the resistance. They hung bodies from lampposts or shot French citizens in the street. Nancy watched in horror. She had been battling the Germans for close to 4 years, but she'd later say that post-D-Day, the war escalated into unmitigated barbarity. The barbarity proved useful for the Germans. Terrified Frenchmen, desperate to save their lives, revealed what they knew about the Maquis, including the location of their hideout. On the plateau above, Chaude's Egg. On June 20th, 1944, the Nazis struck. Just before dawn, Nancy jumped out of bed at the sound of gunshots. Lots of gunshots. The Germans had launched an attack. She, Hubert, and Rake grabbed everything they could. Machine guns, pistols, explosives, Rake's codes. There wasn't a minute to waste. Dodging mortar blasts, they threw everything in a car and fled to the town of Fredifonds, where Gaspard, Fournier, and Laurent were posted. The resistance scouts started streaming into town soon after with reports. There were between 15 and 22,000 German soldiers surrounding the plateau. The Maquis were completely outnumbered. Everyone believed they should retreat and regroup, except for Gaspard, who wanted to fight to the death. Nancy couldn't believe it. Gaspard's stubbornness was going to get everyone killed. She needed to convince him to retreat. Nancy drove outside of town to Rake's position. He was setting up his radio to message London. She told him what to say. Inform them of the German attack, cancel the evening supply drops, and for God's sake, have someone order Gaspard to retreat. When Rake heard back from London, the message said to tell Gaspard to retreat. It was more important to preserve their numbers than to fight to the last man. Nancy was more than delighted, but she knew that Gaspard wasn't going to listen to British orders. She had Rake sign the message Koenig. Marie-Pierre Koenig was commander of the French forces of the interior, appointed to the position by Charles de Gaulle himself. Nancy knew that Gaspard, A man obsessed with honorifics would immediately follow the order if it came from someone like Koenig. It worked. Upon receiving the message from Nancy, Gaspar immediately made plans for retreat. As Nancy raced back to town, she heard the sound of a Henschel HS, a German airplane. She turned around and saw five of them make their way toward Gaspar's location, raining bullets down onto him. Then, two of the planes veered out of formation and headed straight for her. Nancy drove like a bat out of hell, dodging bullets left and right. The back of her car was destroyed by the barrage, but she kept going. One of the airplanes circled back, still firing. They were headed straight for each other. Nancy was terrified. She slowed down, and the change in her speed, incredibly, saved Nancy's life. The bullets completely missed her vehicle. The Henschel attacked Nancy two more times, and both times, she dodged the rain of bullets by changing speeds at just the right moment. When she finally got back to Fredafong, the Henschel was still on her tail. But a Maquisard ran up to her car and stopped her on the edge of town. Everyone had evacuated, but he could find them somewhere safe to wait until the Henschel was gone. Looking up as the plane circled for another attack, Nancy nodded. She and the Maquis fled the car, running for a low ditch. But Nancy stopped short. She'd forgotten something important in the car. She bolted back towards it. Frantically, she threw objects out of the back seat. The Henschel inched closer and closer. She kept looking. There it was, her package. Just as Nancy jumped back into the ditch, the Henschel fired and hit the gas tank, destroying the car in a fiery explosion. Neither Nancy nor the Maquisard could believe what had just happened. When the Maquisard asked what was in the package, she showed him a red satin cushion, some tea leaves, and bottles of cosmetics. The Maquisard looked at her as if she was crazy, but then he burst into laughter, and Nancy, realizing how insane it was, joined him. But the laughter quickly died when she reunited with Rake that evening. The way he carried himself signaled that something was amiss, and it didn't take long for him to tell Nancy some dire news. During all of the fighting, Rake became convinced that the Germans were going to overrun their position. Frantically, he gathered all of his codes and burned them. And on the way out of the camp, he buried his radio set too. Nancy let the information sink in. She couldn't believe it. She understood why Rake did it, but that didn't change what it meant. They were now completely cut off from London. There would be no more supply drops, no more intelligence from headquarters. But Rake had a suggestion. Back in April, when he'd first arrived in France, he'd stayed in a safe house with a man he believed was another SOE radio operator. The man was located in the town of Châteauroux, about 200 miles away. However, there were some caveats. Rake didn't know the SOE agent's name, nor the address of the apartment they stayed at. Nor did he have any kind of password or credential for Nancy to identify herself with. Rake did, however, have a description of the SOE agent. He had hunched shoulders, and a description of the bistro he remembered directly below the apartment. Without hesitation, Nancy decided she was going to bicycle to Châteauroux and attempt to make contact. They needed a radio, and they needed new codes. The Maquis leaders told her it was a suicide mission. The trip was 400 miles through dangerous mountain territory, but Nancy saw no better options. She knew what was at stake. Besides, she had a weapon that none of the men had, her feminine wiles. Mile after mile, Nancy pedaled away on her bike. On those long stretches of road when it was just her, she thought about Henri. about that final kiss they shared at the beginning of 1943. For the last 2 months, she had been 250 miles from Marseille, yet she hadn't been able to get word to him, and she hadn't heard from him either. Was he safe? The thought of reuniting with her husband motivated her to push through the pain. Along the road, she joyously waved at passing German soldiers while cursing their names under her breath. Luckily, she was never forced to stop at a checkpoint. The Germans took one look at this beautiful 31-year-old woman batting her eyelashes and let her roll on by. After cycling for over 30 hours, an exhausted Nancy made it to Châteauroux. By sheer luck, she ran into a maquisard named Bernard, whom she had met a few weeks prior. Bernard, it turns out, was also in town looking for a radio operator. They decided to team up. In the small town, it did not take long for Nancy to track down the bistro Rake described. She climbed to the upstairs apartment, her legs shaking from biking 200 miles. Soft voices came from the other side of the door. But as soon as Nancy knocked, the voices went quiet. She tried three more times. Nothing. Frustrated, tired, and annoyed, Nancy pounded again and again. Finally, the door opened, revealing a man with hunched shoulders. Without a password, Nancy tried a bold, desperate tactic. She bluntly told the agent that she knew who he was and needed a message sent to London. It didn't work. He said no and shut the door in her face. Nancy was incensed. 200 miles biking through Nazi patrols, only to be rejected so quickly, it was maddening. Bernard had better luck. He'd learned that a Maquis group 70 miles away in La Cruz had a radio operator. When he reunited with Nancy, they decided this was their best lead. After another grueling bike ride, Nancy and Bernard pled their case to the Maquis leader. As quickly as the alleged SOE agent above the bistro said no, the Maquis leader said yes. Nancy quickly wrote down her message asking for supplies and providing a new drop point. All she could do now was return to her people and hope the message went through. They would know it was received if and when a supply drop came in a few days. She said goodbye to Bernard, hopped on her bike, and started the 130-mile trek to Saint-Santon. Delirious with exhaustion, Nancy fought through the pain as she pedaled back through the mountains. Sweat dripped down her face and drenched her clothes. If a German patrol were to spot her, she no longer looked the part of an innocent damsel. But luck was on her side. She managed to avoid any interaction with the Germans, riding through the night until she finally made it back to Saint-Santon. She was greeted with shock and then applause as the Maquis realized she had completed the journey in under 72 hours. Nancy downed a glass of brandy, and then another, and then another. But along with the jubilation that Nancy had survived the journey came the question no one wanted to say out loud. Was it worth it? Did the message make it to London? Coming up, the war begins to take its toll on Nancy as she finally learns what became of her husband, Henri. Now, back to the story. At the end of June 1944, Nancy Wake completed the impossible. She bicycled 400 miles across German-occupied France and successfully sent a supply request to London. Now all the Maquis could do was wait to see if London had received the message. Two nights after she returned, Nancy and the Maquis waited at the designated drop point. She stared at the night sky and listened, praying that a familiar sound would arrive. For a long time, all she could hear were the crickets in the grass or the occasional cough from a Maquisard. And then, the sound she had been waiting for. She turned to her comrades and smiled ear to ear. British airplanes appeared in the moonlight with parachutes attached to supply crates descending to the earth. One of those parachutes was attached not to a supply crate, but to a 19-year-old American radio operator named Roger. Roger was to become Nancy's personal operator while Rake, with a new radio, became Hubert's. But the success of Nancy's mission meant that it was time to return to battle. Less than a month had passed since the Allies had stormed the beaches of Normandy, and the liberation of France was still raging. She and the Maquis had a job to do. With the new radios and supplies, Nancy and the Maquis decided to split up their forces. Nancy and her new radio man, Roger, went to work alongside Henri Tardivar, the Maquis leader who greeted Nancy when she landed in the tree after parachuting into France. In August 1944, two American weapons instructors, Reeve Sly and John Alsop, also dropped into France and joined Nancy's group. More and more Frenchmen were volunteering to join the Maquis, and they needed training. Morale increased, but for Nancy, the barbarity of war continued to take its toll. One August morning, Nancy received word that three women had been captured spying on the Maquis. More disturbing was the news that the men had been sexually assaulting them. Angry that her allies could do such a thing, Nancy went to the three women and asked for their side of the story. The first, a 17-year-old French girl, was taken simply because she was beautiful. Through her questioning, Nancy came to the realization that this young girl had no connection with the Germans at all. The second woman had accidentally fallen in love with a member of the Milice, the French version of the Gestapo. It was obvious that the Maquisards were taking their revenge out on the poor woman. Nancy released both of these women and returned their clothing and money. When the third woman was brought in, she was naked and dirty. Though Nancy was at first sympathetic, her sympathy quickly dissolved. The woman was a proud Nazi sympathizer. When asked if she was a spy, the woman said yes. Nancy was conflicted. Here was a woman confessing to being a Nazi. She was the enemy. But she was also a human being. Throughout her entire experience in the war, Nancy had stayed true to her belief that torture was an unacceptable violation of human rights. As with Agent 47, Nancy sentenced the spy to a quick death. The spy was taken out to the forest and presented with a blindfold, which she refused. Instead, she stared at Nancy, who was standing nearby. As the soldiers lifted their guns, the spy gave the Nazi salute and shouted, "Sieg Heil!" When the smoke cleared, the woman was dead. Nancy hoped that she had done the right thing. She ensured that the men who sexually assaulted the prisoners were punished, though the exact sentence they received is lost to history. The days following the incident with the German spy were some of the busiest of Nancy's time in France. The guerrilla war pushed her further and further into German territory. On August 15, 1944, the Allies launched Operation Dragoon, the Allied invasion of southern France. The French Riviera was rapidly liberated. Nancy and the Maquis were instructed to blow up factories and bridges to thwart the retreating German army. While Alsop and Sly were training a group of Milice who had defected to the Maquis, Nancy went to visit Gaspard, Fournier, and other Maquis leaders to see how they were getting on with the increased Allied activity. It was during this visit that Nancy participated in one of her final raids. Nancy learned that a factory in the Montmouchet territory was producing munitions for the Germans. It needed to be neutralized. Under the cover of darkness, Nancy and the Maquis crawled on their bellies and made their way to the factory. Each entrance had two sentries on patrol, marching up and down the perimeter. Nancy and a couple of Maquis waited in the bushes nearby. As the sentries slowly met in the middle of the gate, doing an about turn and then walking away from each other, the Maquis struck. Nancy quickly advanced on her target. She was about to knock him out, but at the last second, just a few paces away, the sentry turned and saw her approaching. In a flash, Nancy acted. Before the sentry knew what hit him, Nancy snapped his neck with her bare hands. As a group of Maquis demolitionists quickly placed explosives in the designated areas, Nancy and another group guarded the entrance in case of a German counterattack. She tried not to look at the man she had just killed. The death of the sentry stuck with Nancy, but not the way many would think. She would later tell biographer Peter Fitzsimmons, "How had I become so aggressive? I remembered Vienna, Berlin, and what the Germans had done to the Jews. I remember my friend in the escape route who had been captured by the Gestapo. That's how I became so aggressive. No, I did not weep for that sentry. It was him or me, and by that time, I had the attitude anyway that the only good German was a dead one." The demolition team finished laying the explosives, and they all hurried back to the safety of the forest. Not long after leaving, all the timers went off. Nancy turned around to watch the massive explosion. As Allied tanks blazed through the French countryside, German soldiers continued to retreat. Paris was in Allied sight. Finally, on August 25, 1944, over 2 months since D-Day and 10 days after the launch of Operation Dragoon, German General Dietrich von Koltitz surrendered. Paris was officially liberated. That night, Nancy and the Maquis, housed in a chateau near Montluçon, popped bottles of champagne and drank the night away. A few days later, on August 30th, the celebrating continued as the Maquis organized a surprise birthday party for her. She was only a 32-year-old New Zealander, but she had played a vital role in the liberation of France. Several days later, in early September, Nancy and the Maquis watched as much of the Nazi army retreated to Germany. They realized they were just over 30 miles away from Vichy, the capital and symbol of the French collaboration with Nazi Germany. If they hurried, they could be the ones to liberate the city. Nancy and her men marched into the collaborationist capital, only to find Gaspar already there. The atmosphere in Vichy was raucous. Immediately upon arriving, Nancy and the Maquis were treated as liberators. Once again, they drank and celebrated well into the night. Champagne and cognac overflowed as Nancy drank herself into a stupor. And then, more exciting news. Marseille had also been liberated. Nancy could not believe it. After a year and a half apart, she could finally, safely travel to see her husband. She longed for the comfort of his embrace after so much hardship. But that happiness was quickly extinguished. Nancy ran into a woman she knew from before the war. She had worked at a Marseille hotel that Nancy and Henri frequented. The woman stared at Nancy, her face turning serious. Henri, she said, was dead. Nancy collapsed and wept. After months of fighting, the sacrifices she made to defeat the Nazis, this was the reward she got. This was how her story ended. That afternoon, Nancy, Hubert, Rake, Alsop, and a Maquis doctor drove to Marseille, weaving slowly through bombed-out roads and bridges. In the days that followed, Nancy pieced together the story of Henri's death. In March 1943, Pat O'Leary had been arrested. While in prison, he came across some information that needed to be passed along to the resistance. he decided that Henri should be that contact. In May 1943, O'Leary's go-between approached Henri at his apartment. When Henri responded, the Gestapo immediately arrested him. The go-between had betrayed both O'Leary and Henri. He was a double agent. For months, the Gestapo tortured Henri. They realized they had the White Mouse's husband, and they demanded information on her. But Henri refused to betray his wife. The Gestapo's patience grew thin. On October 16, 1943, Henri Fioca was taken from his cell and executed. Learning of Henri's death ended Nancy Wake's war. France had been liberated, but at great personal cost. As the rest of the Allies continued marching towards Berlin, Nancy stayed behind. The spirit to fight had gone out of her. It was time to try rebuilding what the war had destroyed. But Nancy's fighting days were not forgotten. She received honors for her work in both the French Resistance and the SOE, including the United States Medal of Freedom, the United Kingdom's George Medal, and France's Médaille de la Résistance, the Croix de Guerre, and the Légion d'Honneur. After the war, Nancy bounced back and forth between Australia and Britain. She tried her hand in Australian politics. When that failed, she joined British intelligence for a couple of years. Then, in 1985, she published a best-selling autobiography, The White Mouse. She was eventually remarried to retired RAF officer John Forward. They stayed together until his death in 1997. After he passed, she sold her medals for money. As she said, "There was no point in keeping them. I'll probably go to hell and they'd melt anyway." She passed away in London on August 7th, 2011. Nancy may have viewed her actions as deserving of eternal damnation, but her legacy suggests that she deserved the opposite. While in her 20s, she successfully smuggled over 1,000 Allied pilots and Jewish refugees out of France, preventing their capture and torture at the hands of the Nazis. By joining the SOE and parachuting back into France, she helped do the impossible, coordinate thousands of civilians into a deadly fighting force. For 4 years, Nancy waged a secret war against the Nazis, and while it ultimately cost her the love of her life, it is impossible to negate the countless lives she saved while working in the shadows. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Kerry Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Espionage was written by Joe Guerra. I'm Carter Roy.